My name's Emma Claire Foley. I'm the campaign director for Defuse Nuclear War, which is the campaign within Reflection that deals with our work reducing the risk that nuclear weapons will be used. I'm here today to teach in as part of the Teach In Network, a project within Roots Action that provides an opportunity for people to organize their own events with expert speakers to talk about a wide variety of foreign policy issues, nuclear weapons issues, and not just like a whole range. So we have a great panel here today to talk about what we're calling militarism in the second Trump administration. I think we all have sort of gotten used to this climate where, reading the news in this year has become sort of overwhelming. And especially even, before then, since the beginning of the Gaza war, it's been really easy to become overwhelmed by the scale of the destruction and the escalation of conflicts that we're seeing. I think it's important to kind of pause. And the idea behind this event was to kind of take a moment, like a few months into this new presidential administration in the United States, and kind of like do an assessment of what overall has changed about the way that the US manages its military, its kind of military power across the world. And so we're gonna hear from three different panelists about different aspects of this question. But the goal is to kind of look at the different levels at which this is a relevant question, right? From the sort of global spread of power and how that's changed and changing even now, to the kind of machinations of national policy within the United States, of spending, and how that has shifted and what those longer term trends are, and then how this kind of works out on the ground, right? In communities across the United States, in changes, economic and social, right, that are kind of downstream from these broader, maybe strategic shifts, but also, affecting them reciprocally. So to try to get a picture of really what's going on with the U.S. sort of military establishment in 2005 or 2025. Oh, geez. Okay. So I'm excited for this. I think we're going to hear we've got some great speakers. And if everybody's ready, we can just dive in. I'm going to introduce our first speaker. Dr. Van Jackson is a professor of international relations at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. He's also a senior non-resident fellow at the Center for International Policy and co-director of the Multipolarity Great Power Competition and the Global South Project at Security and Context. He's the host of the Undiplomatic podcast and the author of the Undiplomatic newsletter. He's written 5 books, most recently The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy with Michael Brennus. Also Grand Strategies of the Left, The Foreign Policy of Progressive Worldmaking. So we're going to hear, I'm excited to hear from Van about kind of his perspective on this question. Van, take it away whenever you're ready.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll start with kind of the biggest of pictures, the zoom out perspective, if you will, and try to make sense of our moment in a way. So we're all probably familiar with like the greatest hits of American militarism since Trump 2.0 came to office, just like the wave top descriptions, $1 trillion Pentagon budget, right? 54% of which has gone to private sector contracts. On Israel, it's almost impossible to be worse on Gaza than Biden, but Trump kind of is. In the past 6 months, he's authorized $3 billion in weapon sales, $7 billion more planned in sale of guns and bombs and missile like technology, like associated systems. The Trump administration reversed the Biden administration's hold on using 2,000-pound bombs, and the Trump administration revoked the National Security Memorandum 20, NSM 20, which had, it's feckless, but it had required certifications from countries that receive U.S. weapons that like they were using them in line with international law, which is becoming a bit of a joke. But like at least the memorandum requirement was there. It's no longer there. The Trump administration rescinded it. And then, of course, the U.S. and Israel have launched bombing campaigns of Iran. The US still has troops in every Middle Eastern country except for Iran and sort of Yemen, depending on how we count it. Trump famously has an ongoing threat to annex Greenland, the Panama Canal. It's possibly a troll, but even Canada. And then he's leveraging tariffs. Like we saw this week, right? On EU countries to get a vague commitment, or he got a vague commitment for, quote, hundreds of billions of dollars of arms sales to Europe, which is going to require imposing austerity on European governments in order to pay for it. And in the UK, that already is happening. In East Asia, interestingly, not a lot has changed, and that's a terrible thing, right? From the previous administration, because we have somewhere around 80,000 troops in the region as part of a kind of containment or China encirclement strategy. In the Pacific Islands region, which is apart from East Asia, next to it, a military buildup is happening in Guam and Micronesia, which are in fact colonial relations of the US that we're exploiting as part of our military strategy. They can't resist our military buildup because they don't have self-determination for the most part. And all of that was going on before Trump. All of that is going on now during Trump. And we have to add ICE to this, of course, right? ICE is Trump's secret police, effectively putting the Proud Boys on the payroll now. But the thing to really stress about that is that the domestic security state is now assembling a global security archipelago of internment camps, which is a kind of, remix version or an interpolation of the black sites that the Bush administration used in the war on terror. So that is like a partial list of nightmares. That list of nightmares was happening under Biden and Obama to a large extent, but Trump is kind of pushing it in certain areas, right? He's pushing it on Gaza. He's pushing it on Iran. He's pushing it on, of course, ICE and on larding the military-industrial complex, which I think is actually the most important and consequential one of these things. But otherwise, this list of nightmares is kind of a bipartisan continuity. And then the question becomes, because of that, like, why is this happening, right? And I think for that, we got to briefly conceptualize what the national security state thinks it's doing under Biden versus Trump. And my shorthand distinction for this would be like a liberal primacy versus an imperialist primacy as US grand strategy. So for more than 40 years, US grand strategy has come closest to what security scholars would refer to as primacy. It's an ideal type, like model of grand strategy. Primacy is a zero-sum strategy of structural domination, and it has three key attributes, right? One is it requires an extreme imbalance of power in the world system, favoring the US. Two is it prioritizes other great powers as the foremost threat to worry about. And then three, it insists on containing or diminishing even hypothetical challenges to US power hoarding, even if it means using force, even if the rising power is an ally. So think like Japan in the 1980s in the Yellow Peril, right? And all three of those attributes were part of US thinking across every presidency since Reagan, all the way up to Biden. And they're also present now. MAGA foreign policy is zero sum. It seeks a favorable imbalance of power. It prioritizes China, which is the other main great power, as the biggest foreign threat. And then, even though it's doing it kind of incompetently and erratically, it is trying to curb Chinese power. So, what's different, I guess, is that MAGA foreign policy has more going on in it than just these primacy features, right? So, with most past presidents, primacy was dressed up in liberal rhetoric and alliances and multilateral institutionalism. But it still had these three key attributes at its core: favorable imbalance of power, great power threats, keeping rising powers down, right? With Trump, the liberal adjective on primacy is obviously gone. We don't even pretend to have it. And in place of that adjective is imperialist geopolitics. So the aims of a primacy grand strategy are kind of being kept alive or tended to by the national security state, by think tankers, by a lot of members of Congress. But on top of that, Trump is doing, not by design, I think by, happenstance, like he's doing a classical imperialist foreign policy. And the reason I can say that is because, again, like with primacy, we can kind of identify what are the objective features that we look for in an imperialist foreign policy. Well, territorial expansionism, rewriting international rules, carving out spheres of influence with other great powers where you collude together, not to just cooperate, cooperation is good, but to dispossess or exploit third parties, right? And then crucially, in an imperialist foreign policy, what Kwame Nkrumah would have called neocolonialism, which is dictating terms of unequal exchange about trade, about finance, about resource extraction with smaller, weaker powers. And that is, in fact, most of the powers in the world relative to the US. So that's what we could call an imperialist foreign policy. That's what we're seeing in spades from Trump, even though he's just kind of like a racist vessel for other interests. And even though a lot of that stuff was going on before Trump, now it's being elevated to a kind of doctrine, like it's being intellectualized and it's being put in service of a white nationalist order building project at home and abroad. And you would think that like the national security state people would chafe at that. And I think like at a rhetorical level, maybe they do, but the national security wonks they've latched onto like a phrase. I've seen them write about this to fit what they do in with this imperialist doctrine, which is minerals for military assistance. So you let us extract your natural resources or dispossess your land, and then we provide you with military assistance or tariff relief or funding for an ICE prison. And that's happening on pretty much every continent, and it's happening in the Pacific Islands too. And then the question becomes, of course, like, why, right? I think this is all a morbid symptom of a crisis of capital accumulation and of declining American hegemony. And I'll explain what I mean by that because it sounds very big. But like that cause, right? A crisis of accumulation and declining hegemony, that cause of our current militarism, it predates Trump, and it's actually what gives rise to Trump. Like those are the conditions that Trumpism is kind of responding to in a way and accelerating. And so I didn't bring the charts with me, but we have had in the capitalist world system for decades a secular decline in global growth, right? Even though we've had record level amounts of productivity since the 1970s. And then we reached a point in the 2000s where what we called neoliberalism now could no longer tell a win-win kind of positive sum story about the global economy and the financialization of the economy, which was a direct response to the declining growth rates of the 70s. It led to a series of speculative bubbles and financial crises, the latest of which, or the biggest of which, was the 2008 global financial crisis, which is something we still haven't recovered from, right? So why am I talking about that in a, discussion about militarism? The reason is because even aside from what the national security state thinks it's doing, there are two like major tributaries feeding American militarism, and they are both downstream of a crisis of capital accumulation. So one is that, I think we know this, America is the land of surplus capital, of wealth hoarding. Since the financial crisis in 08, venture capital firms have had like fewer and fewer places to put their tens, hundreds of billions of dollars that showed the promise of unicorn level returns on investment. At some point, they realized that investing in, apps isn't going to do it, right? And so a low growth world has no place to stash your cash, that surplus. So all the tech VCs, venture capital firms, they bet on Uncle Sam, right? Their surplus accumulation has been going more and more into the military industrial complex. And that's Anduril. That's SpaceX. That's OpenAI. That's Palantir, whose valuation has gone up 400% in the last 7 months, right? That's also what all the AI hype ultimately is. Like, AI is channeling $500 billion of VC investments, and it's not even a profitable technology for the most part, right? The caveat to that is unless you sell it to the Pentagon and to ICE and the IDF, because they'll buy it, right? Now, if the super rich capitalist class thinks it can make money off of the national security state and off of military Keynesianism, do you think that your country is more or less likely to be predatory warmongers? And I think it's a rhetorical question, right? I think the verdict is in. And this is why the great power competition, China threat stuff matters so much, right? A high technology military is only necessary, it's only like justifiable if you plan to fight a high technology adversary. The $1 trillion war machine and the Silicon Valley bet on military production and a military, client, consumer, it has no justification except for hypothetical war with China. Trump doesn't even want to fight China, but the system that he's sitting on top of requires the China threat to justify itself. And then the other tributary, separate from the tech, feeding American militarism is about the specific imperialist form of US foreign policy. So a world of low growth makes capitalists turn toward the use of state power to secure a larger share of a shrinking global economic pie. We're seeing that in China, but we're obviously seeing that in spades in the US, right? So the state secures the bag for its capitalists through what you might call primitive accumulation, a kind of bare knuckle profit seeking. So imperialist foreign policy is how you do primitive accumulation, land grabs, dispossession, a focus on resource extraction, tribute payments, colonial erasure, frontier making. These are evil things, but they are ways also of unlocking or redistributing upward value in a world where capitalism has become too competitive to get rich off of just like wage labor exploitation. And so the tendency of the declining rate of profit and the fact of a low growth world gives rise to state capitalism, which requires a nationalist ideology to bolster it, to fuel itself. Nationalist state capitalism puts you in conflict with others, especially when those others are mirror imaging you. That's what makes Sino-US competition an inter-imperial rivalry within capitalism. And that is the biggest source of the imperialist form of US foreign policy at the moment, right? So you have this national security state quest for primacy. You have the white nationalist order building project. You have the tech bros and the VCs who are leaning into jingoism and patriotism and militarism because it pays. But that also means you have to have the China threat, consequently, which they also promote. And then you have imperialist foreign policy trying to extract new value from a world of low growth. So I guess what I'm saying is like, the militarism of our moment is in so many ways overdetermined. And then that's probably like as much as I should say for now. Thanks.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Very clear, big picture analysis of where we are today, and I think a great way to kick off this call. So just to say for people, we're going to have a Q&A at the end of this, but we're going to go through our speakers first, and our next speaker is Taylor Barnes. Taylor is an Atlanta-based journalist and a field reporter for the military-industrial complex with Inkstick Media, a nonprofit outlet that covers global security, while as a matter of policy, taking no funds from defense contractors or government entities that could color its views. Very rare in that field. You can follow her stories on in Inkstick's free Substack newsletter, Military Industrial America. Taylor, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Emma Claire, for having us. And Van, that was terrific. And my presentation is going to be extremely different because I am going to dive into the hyperlocal. But I think this will be relevant for the people on this call who I imagine often have, a long history in peace movements in their localities. And that's sort of the heart of my beat. And so sort of just to give like some color to the origin story of this beat as I became interested in endless war as a defining feature of American life, as I was, mired in student debt and doing crazy things, attempting to get myself out of debt and wondering, what the US spent its money on, if not, educating its young people. I began to listen into the likes of Bill Hartung and read his books and many peers, and felt like I kept hearing this sort of common line, which was, we can point out everything that's wrong with the F-35 and why it's nuts to spend this much on a fighter jet that like isn't even capable of flying like the majority of times, or like we can tell you everything that's wrong with the ICBM, but nothing will change until the parochial politics around this changes. Like this is a matter of pork barrel politics playing out in the field, and that's why a key node in the military industrial complex, which is the congressional part, keeps the money flowing. So that's sort of the heart of my beat. And sort of just kind of diving into the trends that I'm watching in this Trump 2.0 era. I think as people on this call are very well aware of, you have your conventional big five defense contractors, the Northrop Grumman, the RTX, Lockheed, et cetera. And then these would-be insurgent players, the Anduril, the Palantir, the SpaceX, some of these Israeli startups that are coming to the US, calling themselves quote unquote defense tech, which is a term that Bill on this call has, disputed for a while and that I very much agree with, i.e., weapons manufacturers have always presented themselves on the cutting edge of technology. The defining feature of these firms is that they are venture capital backed and often Silicon Valley in origin. And though they present themselves as in tension with each other, most clearly in Anduril's manifesto, which is published online, in which it claims that it's going to knock out the dinosaurs of the defense industry, like the Lockheed Martins. My prediction, my expectation, I imagine it's shared by many people here, is that everybody's going to do quite well in the Trump era and the era of the $1 trillion Pentagon budget. So as I dive into the hyperlocal, and first as I think of the rise, also just to say, what I don't have a presentation, but I'm going to drop a few links into the chat for people who might want to just visualize what I'm discussing. As I think of the rise of the Silicon Valley venture capital backed weapons firms like Anduril, some places that I'm watching are, for example, right around the Trump inauguration, Anduril announced that it would, Anduril claims that it will have one mega factory that produces its weapons, as opposed to a Lockheed Martin that spreads jobs and subcontracts and whatnot across as many congressional districts as possible. That's not really true. Anduril actually has, a production facility for UAVs here in the Atlanta area. It announced a solid rocket motor plant in Mississippi recently. That said, its would-be mega factory, it also announced within days of the Trump inauguration, and says it is going to build it in outside Dayton, Ohio. One remarkable thing about this is that Anduril, which likes to brag that it, invests in its own R&D rather than waiting for the Pentagon to subsidize its R&D, is getting an enormous amount of subsidies from Ohio taxpayers. It is well over $500 million, and that's just been what's publicly reported from both local and state level tax breaks, rebates, et cetera. And what's even more extraordinary about that is Ohio has a sketchy legal structure that allows it to deprive the public of its contracts to subsidize all subsidized companies, including Anduril, i.e., it uses an outsourced quasi-private nonprofit that's called Jobs Ohio that is not subject to public records law. Therefore, nearly $500 million, or well over $500 million, I believe, has already been, dedicated to this project to build Anduril's mega factory outside Dayton, Ohio, and the public is denied access to what are even the terms of that contract. So that's one thing I'm watching in here. And th then this is, this is me beating a dead horse, but it is just astounding, how much in local media the coverage of weapons plants is not in the context of a national security story. It's not in the context of even like a budget priority story. It is a jobs and economic development beat. So that right, what I just posted is an image of the front page of the I believe it's called the Columbus Daily News, the day that The governor announced that the largest job creation project in Ohio history has been achieved, and it is the Anduril drone plant outside Dayton. And what's remarkable about this is that the media publishes this uncritically, but does not, puts on the front page of the gigantic headline when literally, like, no one in the media is allowed access to the actual contract. Like, that 4,000 job claim sounds great, but like, there's no one's allowed to actually see the fine print that like spells that out, like under what terms. And these like deals routinely underperform. So that's one thing I'm watching in the Trump 2.0 era is sort of the where these Silicon Valley-backed firms announce their plans, and Ohio is an important place to keep an eye on. Another thing is just sort of the culture at contractors as they respond to, the Trump MAGA moment. We had this piece from our reporting fellow recently about these contractors, the likes of Boeing, Lockheed Martin, whatnot, that used to, for example, in their SEC forms, report their diversity statistics and used to sponsor, as amusing as this would be, used to sponsor things like local pride parades, have now backed off and are ceasing to do so, which, it can be amusing to think of the likes of Boeing sponsoring a pride parade. That said, it does mean something to workers on the inside. I had, for example, a queer employee at Northrop Grumman tell me, like, look, I don't even dare join the employee resource group for queer employees because I know the company doesn't have my back as soon as the Trump administration or Republican administration comes into office. And like, I don't want to out myself as queer in this company when like they will turn their backs on me as soon as it is not in vogue with the administration that they need to buy their wares. So I have my eyes on sort of a few cultural shifts along those lines. I've noticed a change in tenor of language from some of the likes of the more conventional defense contractors that I think, if you look at the language from like an Anduril Palantir, I think it's very clear to read the right-wing politics into it. They're very clearly aligning themselves with Trump and the Republican Party, whereas the likes of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, et cetera, often had a more quote unquote bipartisan language. But I have noticed a bit more of the right-wing language in, for example, Twitter posts and whatnot from the big five contractors. Another place to watch, this is this one just occurred to me right now, but is that, of course, the next generation fighter jet contract was announced, then which Boeing won, which will be largely produced in St. Louis, Missouri, which involves interesting local politics for this beat because St. Louis is a dense, heavy, generally blue town, very organized labor heavy, including at the Boeing plants. It's also a place that's been sort of ground zero for Israel and Gaza genocide politics, as AIPAC and the Israel lobby spent so much money to oust Cori Bush in favor of Wesley Bell. So we have a Missouri-based reporter who is really keeping their eyes on how this F-47 contract will be, discussed and promoted locally. I wanted to now, I know many people on this call have an activist bent, so I wanted to hopefully offer a little bit of hopefulness about the ways that ordinary people are pushing back on endless war, and really just put a few, three things on your radar. One is that, so the private defense contracting is largely non-union nowadays. That did not used to be the case back during the Cold War. A place like Lockheed Martin had unionization rates like upwards of like 60 to 70%. These companies have largely been backed by unions. Anduril, Palantir, SpaceX all have zero union representation in the U.S. It's important to watch that Ohio plant and see if there's ever going to be any sort of organizing drive there. That said, the largest union at Pentagon Contractors is the Machinist Union, and that really goes back to the Machinist Union being very tied in with aviation, including civilian aircraft manufacturing. And last year, right before the election, at the urging of a retiree in Connecticut at Pratt & Whitney, which makes engines for both military and civilian aircraft, the Machinist Union undertook an extensive report of essentially how their union could transition into the green jobs era. So, such an era did depend on the Democrats probably winning the White House. That said, it's a pretty it's a pretty remarkable move forward in a union that and rather this the report does not say anything along the lines of we are demilitarizing, we are exiting the defense industry. What instead it says is it points out how many opportunities exist for this union in the clean energy and climate change climate economy. So for example, their vision of who, the machinist union, yes, is, has large numbers of unionized workers at Lockheed Martin and Boeing, but they also organize a lot of federal employees in general, including wildfire firefighters. And they imagine being able to, for example, organize like members of the Civilian Climate Corps in a Green New Deal. So I point this out. Similarly, the United Auto Workers at least has announced a just transition working group. Again, these are very uphill. That said, I think it is meaningful to hear organized labor, though they are a small minority of the private defense contracting workforce, speaking about what we, back in the Cold War would have been called economic conversion. This one is very, very special to me because I report often in Utah. The wealthiest religious organization with very much basically no comparison in the US is the Mormon Church, i.e., the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And this only came to light in recent years thanks to a whistleblower from the investment arm of the church, several investigative reporters, etc. And in a first, a group of activist Mormons motivated by the genocide in Gaza are targeting the investment arm of the LDS Church with a letter writing campaign. They have said they've already sent 250 letters straight to Ensign Peak Advisors, which is the investment manager for the Mormon Church, calling on it to divest from all of several companies targeted by the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. And just to back up, the reason why this is significant is that most churches have long since not invested in the likes of a Lockheed Martin or Boeing or Northrop Grumman, which we've also discussed in our reporting. But because Ensign Peak and the LDS Church largely hid its finances by the time it was forced by the SEC to start reporting them publicly, it actually had those stocks in it and will publicly say awkward things like, oh, many of our, much of our investments is in broad portfolio funds. Don't read too much into it, even though most churches actually do very carefully manage quote, what they call, quote unquote, the sin screens of their investments. So I find this very successful. I find this very interesting because Utah has had some important victories in disarmament. Many people on this call may remember the MX battle, in which, very crucially, the LDS Church came out against a mobile nuclear weapon from the Cold War that would end up being largely scrapped by the Reagan administration. So that's one thing I have my eye on. And finally, this is something that has been in the works. Several grassroots groups in locations that are tied up in what's known as plutonium pit production, so producing the cores of new nuclear warheads for the new nuclear arms race, sued the National Nuclear Security Administration, basically alleging that it had not done a sufficient environmental impact study of the impact of producing new plutonium pits in places like rural South Carolina, Los Alamos, and places tied up in it like Kansas City, Missouri, Pantex in Texas. And a judge agreed and forced and told the NNSA they had to go back to the drawing table and do an extensive, laborious environmental impact study. And what this means is that the public is getting many chances to interface with the national security state, with the nuclear weapons, with the NNSA, and forcing them to listen in mass listening sessions. And frankly, I mean, slowing down the process of making plutonium pits, which didn't seem to be going very quickly anyway. But I find this to be it's remarkable in just the sort of David and Goliath nature of it. I mean, these were tiny watchdog groups, like I said, from rural South Carolina, from Lawrence, Livermore in the Bay Area, et cetera, that had this major legal win. And indeed are throwing a speed bump in the new nuclear arms race. So I know people on this call are come from many a variety of places that indeed have their own tentacles in the military industrial complex. So please put anything in the chat or send me any story ideas. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Taylor. That was really enlightening, and thank you for including the stories of successes as well. We know this is an ongoing battle. So next, I'm going to introduce our third and final speaker. William Hartung is a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and an expert on Pentagon spending, the global arms trade, and U.S. nuclear policy. He is the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and the co-author with Ben Freeman of The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars, and Bankrupts Us at Home, which is forthcoming. His articles on national security issues have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Foreign Policy, The Nation, Forbes, The Hill, Defense One, Inkstick, and Responsible Statecraft all over the map. So, Bill, whenever you're ready, take it away.
Yes, sorry I missed the beginning. The end of Van's analysis was captivating because, here the bigger kind of structural argument, certainly in Washington. Taylor's my hero because she digs up new information, which was like a revelation to me that you could do that. I just kind of repeat myself. I think that the two presentations kind of hit it on the head in the sense we need an understanding of the big picture of why this is happening. But we also need the stories of what's happening with people and how they're affected by this, how they're fighting back. Because I, especially in this environment of disinformation and I don't know what you call it. I mean, fascism is maybe just an outmoded term for what these people are doing. But anyway, to penetrate all that, I think stories of people, stories of past victories, people taking risks, people showing courage is the only way to break through. For a long time, I used to do these very exquisite analyses of the power of the military-industrial complex, and people say, "Yeah, you're right. We can't beat these people." It was actually demobilizing. And so I think the point is only to look at it to give us ideas of leverage and how to kind of bust up the system. And of course, we need stronger movements across the board. But I'm hoping that the situation we find ourselves in will drive us together, and we'll not just play defense, but create a vision of the kind of society we want to build, even if it's not going to happen tomorrow. Which again is not a very Washington kind of thing, because you got to report what you achieved this year, and if this year is you built quietly built the base for change in the future, you can't put that in a grant report, which is why I'm glad we're speaking to Roots Action. I'm so glad Emma Claire invited me, and she's a wonderful writer, organizer, researcher, which is great because people are like, "Bill, how can you do this?" I'm like, "Well, I'm not alone here. I mean, there's a lot of people doing amazing work. Many of whom will carry on long after I'm, sipping margaritas on the beach. Although I don't drink and I don't like the beach, but anyway." So I would say, we're doing this book, The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, which I was adamantly against doing when they asked me because they said, "I've been doing this my whole life. The world's on fire. I can't disappear and write a book in the, for 2 years." But my friend and colleague Ben Freeman, I was visiting him, and he says, "Hey, Bill, I have this great idea for a book," and it was exactly what the publisher wanted. So I said, "Great, we'll do it together." And then ends up this wonderful thing happened, which is Ben and his wife Anna had a baby 3 months after we signed the contract. So I did what I always do when I freak out. I write terrible sentences. So I just like poured out all this stuff. Ben helped me fix it. And the biggest problem was when we were ready to do the cover, we thought the $1 trillion war machine would be outdated by the time the book came out, that they would be spending more than a trillion. But the publisher said they liked the ring of it. So here we are. And I think, one thing that occurred was, we sold it based on an outline. And we mentioned, the tech bros, they're not all bros, but they act like them in Silicon Valley. And, kind of as almost as an aside, and we hadn't really delved into like how important they are politically, how unhinged they are ideologically and personally, and how if anybody is going to get us killed, it's kind of a competition between Trump, Netanyahu, and these Silicon Valley folks. So I think there's a new urgency. And of course, they're selling themselves as we're nimble, we'll be cheaper, our technology will restore U.S. dominance in the world. We're the new patriots. We're founders. They kind of sell themselves as superior beings, and we're supposed to you sort of, thank them and also make them rich at the same time. The question becomes like, how are these two factions going to relate? Andrew has a little manifesto called Arsenal Democracy 2.0. It's a pretty good critique of the big companies and parochial politics and all of that. And they basically say, well, these companies were good for the Cold War, but they can't make the new weaponry. They don't have the business model. They don't know the software. Let's give them a lifetime achievement award. Let them get out of the way, and we'll take over. And because people are enamored with tech, and because they feel like, well, we got to have competition in the defense sector. This is a good thing, Bill. But there's almost no way this turns out well if we let these people have more power. They're selling technology that doesn't exist yet, and making it sound like, it's at their fingertips, and that technology will save us, which it has never done in the past. And the Alex Karp, the head of Palantir, has this wonderful book. I mean, wonderful if you're one of them, which basically says, America's kind of lost its way. We're a bunch of slackers, all we do is game and watch reality TV. We don't produce anything more. We need a unifying national mission. And lo and behold, what's it going to be? A new Manhattan Project for military applications of artificial intelligence. And he says in the book, well, we can develop a permanent superiority over China in this technology, as if we're like fighting Iraq or something. I mean, this is this large, technically capable country with a growing economy. And if we want to poke them, they have many more resources to throw at their military that they're doing currently. And this notion, at the end of the, we're coming up on the 80th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. And there was that debate, should we control this technology? Should we eliminate it? What should we do? And the hawks basically kind of sold the idea, well, we're in the driver's seat here. We've got these weapons. We can run the table on the notion that, oh, Russia and China won't get this stuff unless they cheat. And of course, they did get it, and we've got the arms race. So now you've got this guy saying, oh yeah, we're gonna dominate, and we're gonna have a permanent edge in this AI technology, and it's gonna restore American dominance in the world, which you may have noticed is not always a good thing. I think what Taylor alluded to, I think for the moment at least, they're going to feed both sides. The Lockheed Martin folks are a little more buttoned down, like they don't scream from the rafters, we're going to beat China, but they fund think tanks that say that. And they don't sort of glory in war, that they tell the investors, well, that turbulence will certainly create a market for our products. Whereas these other folks are like, I want to live forever. I'm going to colonize space. We're going to bury China. They're much more aggressive in their presentation. Their weapons have a lot of dangers associated with them, including the idea of if you think you're not going to pay a price, you can inflict great damage on others. And essentially, in my view, the United States is a declining imperial power. And the question is, can we age somewhat gracefully, or we're going to take the rest of the world down with us? And a lot of Trump's policies actually, I think, are accelerating decline because they are getting rid of tools that, like, a more quote unquote intelligent imperialist would want. Like, well, there's ways to use foreign aid for leverage, and there's ways to use international institutions to advance US interests and so forth. Their policy seems to be, we're going to bulk up the military, which is going to be like a version of the Michigan militia with better guns. Let's get rid of diversity. Let's get rid of anybody who would stand up to the president. Let's not have a military that represents the scope of America. Let's not remember that their first job is supposed to be to honor the Constitution, not put down demonstrations in Los Angeles. So it's a new level. I think it was all present, but Trump is just screaming it from the rooftops. Even if you look at things like, kind of the racial underpinnings of American society. When Ronald Reagan ran for president, he announced at Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was where four civil rights workers had been murdered in the 60s. And they said, oh, it's a racist dog whistle. Well, Trump, it's a racist bullhorn. It's every day, it's relentless. They're trying to make it, try to normalize racism to every possible degree, including, oh, let's rename the forts after the Confederate generals. I want to call them the Reds. Even things that seem, and in some ways are secondary, but are indicative of a particular ideology that is particularly particularly, I think, dangerous and, I think not necessarily un-American, but inhumane. It's not what we should be about. So, I think to turn this around, there's certainly the money factor. There's the fact that, our politics are such that all the things we could do that would build a more sustainable society and create more jobs are blocked in Washington. It's, capitalism for the rest of us and socialism for these big companies. So there's a political blockage to doing what's rational. Even if you were kind of a middle of the road, kind of, vaguely hawkish Democrat, this system doesn't really work. I mean, if the Pentagon wants to build new weapons, adjust strategy, Congress says no. It's like, oh, this ship doesn't work. We don't care. You can't retire it. So it's kind of this weird, the Pentagon budget's sort of like a sedimentary rock or something. It's just like generations of things that they've built and they rarely get rid of anything. And now, things like Golden Dome, which is, I mean, back when Reagan said he was going to have an impenetrable missile shield, practically every scientist who wasn't on the payroll of the industry said that's not possible, and they were correct. But back at the time, Edward Teller, who was the father of the H-bomb, among other things, was whispering in Reagan's ear, "Oh yeah, lasers in space—that's the solution." Well, it ends up the lasers in space dissipated; they couldn't really do anything. But in the meantime, they had put an artist's conception of this thing on the cover of Time magazine. A lot of people thought we had it. So they've already proven that this leak-proof system is not going to work against ICBMs. And Trump says, "Well, also hypersonic missiles and low-flying cruise missiles." It's a fantasy, but it's also a huge boondoggle. And for the two factions of the industry, it couldn't be better because they're going to use some of the existing hardware that the Lockheed Martins and RTXs build, and then they're going to have an Anduril or a SpaceX or somebody kind of doing systems integration and targeting communications. Likewise, the F-47 is going to have these unpersoned, wingmen that'll be built by Anduril or one of these other firms. So at the moment, at least, they're feeding both sides of the beast. Maybe eventually they won't be able to do that. But, there's very little discussion about, well, what's the strategy to defend the country? I'll end on this, but there was a Congressional Commission on Strategic Posture, co-chaired by John Kyle, who not only was the most anti-arms control senator in the history of the U.S. Congress, but had been a lobbyist for Northrop Grumman, which is the biggest nuclear weapons producer. And when they released this report, this was not mentioned. He was treated as just objective observer of the passing scene. And then they had a hearing in the Senate Armed Services Committee, which was shameful. I mean, they're saying, this is what we need to protect the country. This should be our nuclear doctrine. This is what we should be spending. You would think they would ask questions about that, but most of them said, "Hey, this missile that we build in Arizona is the only one that can really block a hypersonic missile. Shouldn't we spend more on that?" Or from Nevada, "Well, the Nevada test site, there's a lot of investment that needs to go in there that, we got to accelerate that, right?" Or like the guy from Alabama is like, "We make everything. We're amazing, And then finally, Senator Warren says, "Well, just out of curiosity, what is your plan going to cost?" So the former lobbyist for Northrop Grumman says, "Oh, cost. This is much too important to worry about cost." And of course, it segues with Taylor's work, where they claim all these economic benefits, most of which are illusory. So, it's business as usual in Washington. Like, people are like, "How do you figure this out, stuff, Bill, about the pork barrel politics and the connection?" Well, I watched the hearings. Like, they're bragging about it. But, what would it take to have an actual conversation in the Congress that said, "What's the best way to defend the country?" It doesn't happen. It's all about money and kind of, just taking positions that they feel will serve so they can survive politically in the narrow sense of Washington, which is why whatever we do to turn this around, it's got to start outside of Washington. I won't get into deep critiques of my colleagues, but there's a lot of the DC-based groups have set their sights so low. It's like, what will Congress accept? Almost nothing. We need a new Congress. We need a new public consciousness. We need a larger movement. Ideas alone are not going to do it. We need power, and we don't have that at the moment. So, it's really, I think, the most important people on the call are the people from Boots Action who are trying to organize and change people's minds. And it's hard work, and we're up against, frightening deadlines. If you look at both climate and the acceleration of militarism and conflict. But I think, we have to sort of get grounded. We have to fight back. We're going to be driven together across all these different issue areas, not just because they're related, in terms of changing the country, but because we have to defend ourselves from this regime, which is trying to undermine every possible critic. I mean, to me, what they did to the ceasefire movement at universities was like a test run for what they're doing to the rest of us, or what they're doing to immigrants and undocumented workers is what they're going to do to the rest of us. And it's well along. I really will stop. I talk too much. But the year before this was the centennial of the birth of James Baldwin, and there's a Black History library in Harlem, and they had a thing about the public intellectual. And so one of the panelists was a Palestinian woman, and when she spoke the truth, she got death threats. There was a couple African American professors, and they spoke truth to power. They got their jobs were threatened. And then there, here I am sitting in New York, kind of this cranky old white dude. And, I say the same thing, and they call me names, or they say, "Well, you're pro Putin, you're pro this, you're pro that." So in my darker moments, I'm like, "Well, at least I'm for something, But obviously, that's not going to fly in the larger picture. But nonetheless, there's different levels of risk for different people and different kinds of activism. And I think we need to support the people on the front lines. We need to take whatever level of risk we're willing to take. Those of us who are more privileged, I think, have to be more vocal, especially now. I have a huge responsibility, and we have to act. A lot of people, I am betting there's tens of millions of people who are just like paralyzed by what these folks are doing. Steve Bannon said years ago, "Well, it's about muzzle velocity. If you fire six bullets at a time, they'll block two and the other four will get through." And that's kind of what the Trump folks are doing. And nobody has like the answer, but I think unless we pull together, unless we build community, unless we trust each other, unless we get in motion, we're not going to figure it out. And so I am strangely motivated, which is probably a good thing. But I also feel like, these people are trying to occupy my country and the world. I'm not going to let them occupy my mind. I'm not going to get depressed. I'm not going to stop fighting. I'm not going to stop working with these amazing colleagues I have. And I think we can turn this thing around, but it's a long-term fight. And so I think, I noticed in my student days, if we fought a couple of years and we lost, some people would say, "Well, I tried." And some of us stayed in it. And we need more people to stay in it, because the future of humanity is at stake one way or the other, either whether we survive or whether we build a world worth living in. I mean, it's not just about money and the grind. And I don't even know some of these people, like, what are they going to do with more money? I mean, is greed really a sufficient basis for humanity? So anyway, I'm maybe gone far enough, but all I'm saying is they're on the march, but they can't save capitalism. They can do an amazing amount of damage, and we need to mobilize even at the moments that we don't know exactly what the answer is. We have to get together. We got to fight. We got to stand up. We got to take risks, and we have to trust that we can turn this around. And it's not guaranteed, but it's necessary that we fight this fight. And I'm glad there's people out there doing this, because I'm very grateful for every bit of organizing anybody does, because that's really what's going to turn this around. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill. That was really inspiring. And thank you to all the panelists. This has been a really amazing event. And I feel like I've learned a lot, even as someone who reads and listens to all of your work. I want to ask, we're going to do a quick plug for the Teach-In Network to just let people know how they can organize events like this in their own communities, for their own groups, like if they'd like to. I know we've seen some interest about that in the chat. And it is 9:02, and I did say this call would end in an hour, but I wanted to ask if the panelists would be willing to stick around for 5 to 10 minutes of Q&A. You have that time? Not
Yeah, that's fine.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So I'm going to introduce my colleague Ryan Black to tell us more about the Teach-In Network, and then we'll go to the Q&A.
Thank you, Emma Claire, and thank you to our excellent speakers and to everyone for being here. Teach-ins like this are a useful way to share expert perspectives with our communities and organizing groups, and we want to empower you to organize your own. We started the Teach-In Network as campus protests were being villainized across the country, as Bill just mentioned. And so our goal is to help make organizing a teach-in safe and easy. We provide resources and connect you with vetted expert speakers. The network is comprised of toolboxes that include primers, presentations, videos, and more. And of course, access to experts, many of whom are listed on our website, which I will post in the chat now. Here's a link with many of our speakers who have already agreed and are waiting on emails from us asking them to join a teach-in. We just organized an in-person one in Tucson that's going to be happening in a couple weeks. So I urge you, even if you never have, to take the next step and organize your own teach-in for your local organizing group or student group or whoever you meet with regularly or organize with. Please reach out to me via the Teach-In Network website, which you can get to through that link I just posted, or email me anytime at ryan@rootsaction.org if you want to organize with us. Thank you, and back to you, Emma Claire.
Thanks so much, Ryan. So I'm gonna go into the chat. I know I saw a few questions for our panelists. Scrolling up, I think, David, your first question for Van. We can start there, which is your book, Van, has made a great case that the Cold War had numerous bad effects on US domestic society. What impacts is the current hostility toward China having on people in the United States who don't imagine that foreign policy impacts them?
Yeah, I mean, so just quickly, I guess, the great power competition framework thing, it's the intellectual basis for this trillion-dollar war machine stuff that we've been talking about. So everything that Taylor was talking about on the ground that is affecting real people, that traces directly back to this idea that these abstractions about the balance of power and like predatory great powers and all that stuff. Like, once again, you don't need a sixth generation fighter aircraft to take on cartels, to bomb the Houthis. You don't even need it for Russia. You only need it for China. It's the only conceivable use case for the $1.7 trillion of nuclear modernization, right? All of it. So all of this death-dealing machinery hangs on this notion of great power competition, which is why it's so sticky. But also, like what we document in the book, there's a whole chapter about the political consequences. So like the way we frame it is like great power competition is bad for both political and economic democracy. So political democracy, like far right, the rise of the far right, the political polarization within America, the presence of a formidable external threat heightens polarization. It does not rally around the flag. It doesn't bring us together. If we're already like a very stratified society that's, organized like the class distinction, the 1%, 99%, and all of that, the foreign threat becomes an excuse to heighten that further. Politicians engage in demagoguery and hawkish outbidding. And the consequence of all of this ends up being not just the resurgence of the far right within American politics, which is obviously what we're seeing, but also spikes in anti-Asian violence. There's like a ton of track record of this since great power competition. It directly caused spikes in anti-Asian violence, almost half of which, the numbers bear this out, is against Asians, not just Chinese, even though it's about China, which is like the racialized element to all of this. And then finally, like, I think, Taylor and Bill know this too well, but like the job multiplier effect from federal spending on the military is it's the worst jobs program you could possibly construct, right? It's worse, every dollar for dollar, the spending on the military is worse for creating jobs than spending on like almost any other sector of the economy. And on top of that, this modern military bullshit. Sorry. Military spending is capital intensive in the modern world. It's not manpower intensive. So you pour money into the military and it buys more stuff. It's a terrible way to buy more jobs, you know? So, I don't know, not good. Lots of ways in which this is bad for normal people, you know?
Not good indeed. So we have a question for Taylor. Coming off of your describing the some of the successes of this movement, do you have any recommendations for local peace groups, many of whose members are on this call tonight?
Yeah, I was really excited about that question, and I feel like I have too many answers, so I'm going to try to keep it brief. But my general umbrella answer is that as we do this reporting, both myself and other allies in the field and watchdog groups, I just find over and over again that the likes of Northrop Grumman, of Anduril, their allies in government, they are so shocked and taken aback when anybody comes at them with anything adversarial in the field. And like it's they like You know, like Northrop Grumman has like lawyered up to fight like a public records request we submitted whatever 2.5 years ago in Utah, and you know it's quite wild. So just to say that like that scrutiny in the field means a lot to them. And one sort of too long don't read like journalist general tip is like anytime you see the company interacting with government in any sense, I need a permit. Like Anduril apparently is asking Ohio taxpayers to like fund their new sewage line so they can like get help flushing their toilets at their mega plant. So any interaction like that, getting their tax breaks, whatever, involves some form of public record, at least go ahead and request it. And that is already sort of the first sort of line, the first easy line of scrutiny. This story just makes me smile because I just think it again shows like how much these companies are not used to scrutiny in the field. Earlier this year, a building exploded at Northrop Grumman's final assembly plant for the new intercontinental ballistic missile, which is like a many decades old, from the dating back to the 1950s missile plant out in Utah's West Desert that has a history of many explosions, including that have killed numerous workers. And I got a tip from a worker basically in real time as it was happening, like, Taylor, a building is exploding right here. And not just myself, but local media, indeed, it made houses shake like 5 miles away. Local media picked it up, they flew a helicopter over the site. And this apparently infuriated Northrop Grumman that anyone knew that they exploded a building out in Utah's West Desert. And they sent an email out to employees saying, please do not speak with the media, which then I was told about. All of which is to say is that many of these powerful companies really do expect a cozy environment in the field. And I think any scrutiny that you give is far more than were expecting. I think inserting yourself in local narratives and just providing any sort of a counter narrative can be very valuable. For example, with this new Anduril plant in Ohio, I noticed one local official in one of the counties that is offering tax breaks to the plant said something along the lines of like, I wouldn't bet against Anduril. And this like what he's saying is like, what a great successful company we are giving tax breaks to. Of course they will create jobs. And I thought, what a funny thing to say. Like, this is a very untested weapons manufacturer. You're saying I would not bet. And I'm like, has anyone told him that Palmer Luckey is a gamer? Like that is his actual professional history. So I think any of those counter narratives in the field can go far because local officials are often pretty clued out of them. One thing, just I didn't put this on my local success stories, but I think not underestimating just who has an interest in stemming endless war. Recently in Nevada, the Nuclear Threat Initiative ran a very remarkable campaign that reminded me a lot of the MX battle in Utah in the 1970s and 80s, in which they gathered just a variety of local interests, everything from like labor unions to like a casino association to the Cattlemen Association, to come together to support a resolution in the state legislature opposing a resumption of nuclear weapons testing at the Nevada test site because a resumption of nuclear testing had been a plank in Project 2025. And bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats alike, in the Nevada state legislature came back and came and unanimously supported this resolution. So I think of looking at entry points in which people's lives in very physical ways intersect with endless war is important because quite often in cases like this, people will decide that it is not in their interest to have nuclear weapons testing resume in their backyard.
Thank you. Lots of threads to follow there. One more question for Bill now. Trump has stripped away the facades and made war look just as ugly and evil and fraudulent as it always was. But do you feel that opposition to war has increased correspondingly?
I think that there's a lot of war fatigue, a lot of attitudes against war, but I think because of the way this administration came in, a lot of people are still on their back heels because there's so many horrors being perpetrated upon us. People don't know where to start. And this was part of the point of Project 2025 and the whole purging of the government was they don't want anybody who's going to stand up to Trump. And they want to push the pace on these things so people don't know what hit them. And so, but I think that the anti-war sentiments will come together. And I think we're going to build a substantial movement. You notice every once in a while, Trump will say something like, well, nuclear weapons are, there's too many, they cost too much, let's get rid of them. Or he gave a speech in the campaign in Wisconsin where he said he's going to drive the warmongers and war profiteers out of Washington, and they just want to go to war because they get $2 million a missile. Well, guess what? He's not doing anything about it. But I believe the reason he said it is because there's a portion of his base who is angry about that stuff, doesn't want that stuff. And even when he ran the first time, beating up on Jeb and Hillary about the Iraq War, which was supposed to be verboten for, Republican candidates, some of the vets who voted for him bought it that he was going to be a anti-war president. So there's a pocket on the right that's anti-war, but it's not elected officials, it's not journalists, it's grassroots folks. And given the way our country's been divided and just kind of the hate as a political strategy, can we connect in some way? Can we work in parallel? How do we touch that? And then I think the there's a lot of people who haven't participated to the degree they could. The Poor People's Campaign has a new kind of campaign, which is basically they looked at how low-income communities survived COVID, often with very little help from the government, sort of the networks of mutual aid and resilience. And so they've got a campaign that's called Survive and Revive. Basically, those bonds, that building of community, has to be combined with political education, political action. And they hearken to things like the free breakfast programs of the Black Panthers, or things that you wouldn't normally associate with Donald Trump's America. But I think there's a whole separate kind of learning going on, and respect for radical efforts of the past. And I think we can bring that together in a way that can be meaningful. But it's a race against time, and these folks are just they're trying to destroy as much as possible, as quickly as possible. And the Silicon Valley folks kind of seem to believe we don't need government. Well, they certainly want as little government as possible. So, we got to stand up to these folks, and we have to call them what they are, which is a bunch of new age militarists who don't believe in democracy. And so they're not giving us any gifts here. We have to, I think, mobilize against this idea that, tech is what it's about. Because if you look at Star Wars, the electronic battlefield in Vietnam, precision guided bombing, it hasn't won any of the objectives the Pentagon claims it has had in these wars, but it has killed hundreds of thousands of people, cost trillions of dollars, inflicted great pain on our troops and our vets. So if you just take a cold, hard look at this notion of peace through strength, we've been there. We've seen it doesn't work. And people have to let go of that kind of ideology and open their eyes and try to build a better society. So I think we have that on our side, but we have this whole history and all this baggage to work through. And I think it's going to take a certain amount of tolerance of difference in the resistance, that not everybody's going to be on the same exact page in terms of what to do, how far to go, but we can respect that and find ways to work together. So of course, this is from guy mostly sits at his computer, so you might want to talk to some organizers as well. But this is what I'm learning from my friends who do organize anyway.
Can I use two fingers super quick? The like a recurring message I try to drive home to people is like, no peace, no democracy. And so it doesn't matter, as long as we have this electoral system that where we can still nominally vote for people and express our preferences. If our representatives, who are the effect, most of us would be the Democratic Party, if they are fusioned to the national security state, and they're like former CIA case officers, and now they're senators and that kind of stuff. It doesn't matter. Like, we will never have democracy in any meaningful way outside of the ballot box. Like, it's the repudiation of peace and its militarism that is the constantly, perpetually choking off serious democracy, meaningful democracy. So whether it's at like the local level or the state level or the federal level, there, if there's not a peace movement involved or an anti-militarist commitment from our representatives, we're fucked. Sorry about that.
Which was going to be the title of their book, but they changed it. But I think that's one of the strongest parts of your book is the domestic effects of all this, because they make it sound like we have to be strong to protect democracy. In fact, what they're doing is hollowing out, destroying
Yeah,
democracy.
totally.
Great. Thank you all so much. Thank you, everyone, for staying a little late. This has been great. I'm gonna have a sign off now. There's gonna be just one more thing. We're gonna bring Ryan back to tell you about the other events we have planned as part of the Teach-In Network and Roots Action. So Ryan, whenever you're ready.
Yeah, we have, sorry, we have another event coming up on August 21st about immigration and ICE raids. I believe David Swanson is helping set that one up. So we will have more information coming out about that one soon. And then we have another one in the early stages getting organized for September 11th about the before, during, and after effects of September 11th, what that did to the United States and the world, domestically and foreign policy wise. So hope you will join us for those, and you'll be receiving emails about those in the coming weeks.
The hits just keep on coming. So thanks everybody one more time. And hopefully we'll see all of you back here for our future teach-ins.
Great.
Have a great
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Emma. Thanks everyone for joining too.
Thank y'all.